Hey peeps, welcome back to Craft Truck's continuing series of podcasts here with the wonderful one and only
Hey.
What
hey,
is that?
It's Emily. I'm here. They let me out of my cage.
She's our gimp. Anyway, so basically, Lindsay Klingman, an unbelievably interesting editor, has started. Like, I mean, she told stories about basically cutting industrial films for like ad agencies when she was like, you know, in her 20s. And they were like, oh, you know, what's the name of that girl again? Like Mad Men. It was like ridiculous. And she lived that. And she cut her first two films that she cut were both Academy Award winning documentaries.
Take that, boys.
Yeah, which is crazy. And she just, with just, you know, not an ounce of ego, anything on her, she was awesome.
So she cut such films as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Is it cuckoos or cuckoos?
I think it's cuckoos. For sure. It's only one
there
of
the... There was a nest and someone flew over it and it won an award.
It's one of the three films only ever to win all four of the major Academy Awards, or five of the major Academy Awards, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And really easy to pronounce.
Yeah.
Also, Little Man Tate, Man on the Moon, and Ali. So, yeah, she's big time.
Hardcore.
Nice. So yeah, have a listen, and if you want to check out the video version of this interview, go over to crafttruck.com. Thanks for joining us, peeps.
Thank you.
I'll just teach you simple cuts to start with.
I won't bite you out here.
Oh, movies. Are we filming?
Yeah.
Oh.
This is the whole deal.
Well, I left Los Angeles. I mean, I left New York because it was difficult there.
Mm-hmm.
I had, but I went to college. I finished at Columbia, and I graduated college with my degree in history, and not a clue what to do. And then I found out people worked in film and made money, and this was a concept.
That was like shocking.
It was so fabulous. Right. So I thought, oh, well, my history background's great. I'd like to make movies on the Russian Revolution and on the Depression and, you know, like that. So I started going around to every place listed in the yellow pages under film editing, not having a clue what film editing was.
Mm-hmm.
But my father was a newspaper editor, and it sounded sort of like that.
Right. You just take what somebody else does,
yeah,
and you change it a bit, and then that's what you get.
That's what I kind of thought. And one day when I was unwrapping a little red grease pencil, it occurred to me that I was using the same tool he was using. This is when we had film, and we'd mark up the film.
Up and cut it like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what was your first actual editing job? I'm presuming you were an assistant sound editor first.
No, I was an apprentice. I was an apprentice in a editorial house,
right,
and they did every kind of film. They did, where should I look?
Anyway, at me, or at the camera, or it doesn't matter.
Should I look at him? Should I look, okay.
You can look at her.
If you're there, okay. My first job was
just
in
so
an
you know.
Editorial house.
Right, but just I'm just going to interrupt you.
Yeah.
You should know that we're going to take what we're shooting here,
uh-huh,
and we're going to do this little thing to it called editing.
Yeah, I figured. That's why I started the paragraph again.
I know. So the funny thing is I was interviewing a cinematographer, and I asked a question. It was kind of like inappropriate. I said to him something like, why is it the Quebecois make such better films than the English Canadians? And I realized if that got out, if I said it like that, it would like offend half of my...
Wait, you said the French-Canadian films were better than the...
Much better, because they are. They are much better. I mean, you know, whatever. Anyway, so then I asked him, he answered the question, then I asked it again and differently. And then he looked at me, and then I asked it again differently. And I said, okay, we can move on. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm just asking the question so I can cut it back in later. And he went, oh, you're asking... Oh, I've never seen anyone do that before. And I was like,
Yeah.
Anyway, so anyway, point is that anything that is embarrassing is, or not embarrassing, but anything that you that won't work is gonna, you know this stuff. It's gonna go. So don't worry about it.
Okay. Well, I talking about my family never sets me at ease. To be honest,
I was actually trying to do the opposite.
I know you are.
Yeah. We can talk about it. What does set you?
So
at
anyway,
ease?
I met someone who is a film editor.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "You mean you make money and you make movies?" Yeah. So, and this was before the women's movement, before a lot of stuff. I assumed I'll just get a job, and one of these days, some rich guy's going to come along, and we're going to get married, and he'll pay my bills, and I don't have to work. I have to have babies.
Right.
And
this was actually the plan, was to get married.
Well, this was what women did at that time.
Right. Okay.
I was a bridge generation. I mean, 2 years later, I was on the streets with all the other women. But at that time, I would go around to different editorial houses. Mm-hmm. I had a list from the phone book. And they would say, "We don't hire women because you can't carry a lot of cans, because we don't want to have to watch our language. La, la, la." And although there were women working in the industry, I never ran into them. Nobody ever introduced me or told me about them. And I did have, for maybe 3 years, I didn't meet any women doing what I was doing.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and it was back then we're talking.
But I wasn't doing, I mean, you know, I was in the trenches. Armand Film Services did everything from industrials, which was things that were sponsored by big companies like IBM and Monsanto did a wonderful animated film on color, and Gulf Western did something on golfing.
And you're in the editorial department.
Now, what I'm doing is I walk in and they say, first they hired me because they said to me, "Oh, we need a girl around to answer the phone, make coffee, and cut the negative and read the soundtracks." Now, I knew nothing at all, and I learned from my mistakes, but this was in the old days when we had film, separately sound.
Yep.
It was a whole different universe.
All 35, some of it was 16.
Some was 16, mostly 35, but okay. A lot of 16, because so there were documentaries there.
You had to go to the process where you learned how to mark things, how to tape them, put them in bins and takes.
No, the first thing I learned was to cut negative, and I made mistakes, but nobody seemed to notice, because it was a very quick-cut film. And when I walked in the first day of film, they said, "This is the negative, don't put your fingers on it, and this is the picture, don't get any ashes on it."
Because everyone smoked.
Everybody smoked,
right,
including me.
Right.
So this is, you know, a different universe.
Right. But you learned how to edit.
No, I didn't learn how to edit.
What did
you only
learn
how to edit. Technique. I learned how to read soundtracks. I learned how to splice. I didn't know. I only did, because I was negative cutting, I didn't know about tape splices. You know, so I learned by mistakes. By physically doing it, I learned. But I was really...
So let's because I think this is interesting for somebody watching, let's be clear. By the same way you're saying, "I didn't know how to edit, I just knew how to clip things together and technically use these things," is the same thing...
Barely.
But it's the same thing today as when somebody gets, like, their computer and they get Final Cut or they get Premiere on it and they figure out what an endpoint...
But they know how to work a computer.
Okay, but I'm saying
that's how far
the technique of edit or the craft of editing, the art of editing is.
Well, I wasn't there yet.
Right,
I wasn't there yet. I was working
in the same
in a place
way that someone who gets a computer and gets the software doesn't know thinks they know how to edit, but they don't yet.
Right.
That's my point. Is it just like every
right?
You know, every fifth person out there has an editing film.
You want to talk about editing? Okay, so there I was with my apprenticeship done at Armand Film Services,
right,
and not done. Just done because I didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
Once too many. And I flew to California because my best friend at the time was going to UCLA Film School. So I hung out with her, and to all these people at UCLA Film School, I was a working editor.
You were the
I was
pro.
A big shot.
Yeah, you were the pro.
So I got stuff to cut, and I learned a little bit by doing.
Yeah.
And I got some jobs out here, but I always went back to New York. And
what did you do when you went back to New York?
I got more jobs. I started working as an assistant in a commercial house, and I worked there for 2 years, and it was one of the best commercial places in New York.
And now what are you doing there?
What I was doing there was, Well, I would go to Daly's. Now, this is the interesting thing. I'd go to Daly's, and there was one commercial that involved a very long shot, but also a long shot that moved in on a person on a ladder. And this person walked up the ladder, and the camera moved in and stopped. And I remember sitting through 19 takes of this, and people around me are going, oh, that's too slow. That's great. I don't like the light there. And I'm looking at these 25-second shots.
Takes.
And I don't see any difference between anything because I didn't know what to look for because I had an uneducated eye. So I often think about that. Like, I didn't have a clue what they were talking. I was writing, but I didn't know what they were saying. It took time for me to get it, what editing was and what to look for in shots and how to... The whole thing takes time, I think. Mm-hmm. Now, I learned through experience. Mm-hmm. And it was a little harder then because you didn't have access to the film until you were an editor or an assistant. But you couldn't cut the film because there'd be splices. So you couldn't really fool around much. So
So that was New York Commercial House?
Commercial House. Then I met a guy. Now,
just to put a pause, around what time is this?
Do I have to tell you the year?
Yeah.
I was around 68,
okay. You mentioned you were in the streets with the women. When you said I was in the streets with the same women 2 years later, so I'm assuming it was 66.
I don't remember if it was 2 years later.
But it was probably around... So
68 was the big year of everything.
68 was the year the world changed, yeah.
Yeah, my world too.
Film changed, everything
changed.
Around the world, everything changed.
Everything changed.
Yeah.
And I was in the anti-war movement.
Yeah.
And I met a guy who was making a film about Vietnam.
Who was that guy?
Emil D'Antonio, who had did Point of Order, which, do you know?
No.
It's a brilliant film taken from the kinescopes of the Army-McCarthy hearings. And it's the moment of Eugene McCarthy, who was Mr. Anti-Communism. I have here a list of 80,000 communists in the State Department full of lies when he got his comeuppance.
Right.
And it was during the Senate hearing. That I think I was 4 years old when my parents bought a television so we could watch it.
Right. So you, this man...
So I knew who he was, and I was thrilled.
To meet this guy.
To meet this guy and to work on a film on Vietnam, which I did for about a year and a half, 7 days a week, 20 hours a day, very little money. But I started learning how to edit. Not much, but, you know, it was really great to work on something I believed in.
And what... Oh, that's interesting. It's great to work on something you believed in.
Yeah, I felt we were doing something important. We were monitored all the time by the FBI because D would get this... Everybody called him D, Emil D'Antonio. D would find these connections in Sweden and in Argentina that would handle footage that wasn't seen by the Americans yet, and the FBI would be there once a week saying they worked for a college newspaper, and they were just checking how the film was coming. You know, it was a very exciting time, really. And the film is very strong. It's not very well structured. It's too long. There's a lot of editorial disasters about it. But let me tell you, if you see it and sit through it, it's such a strong history of American foreign policy.
What's the name of the movie again?
It's called In the Year of the Pig. It was nominated for a documentary Academy Award for feature-length documentary. It was the first film I ever cut. I didn't even know it was nominated until I noticed in the newspaper. Nobody told me.
how long did you cut the film for? A year and a half?
I was about 16 months.
And what was the final runtime of the movie?
Too long.
Too long. Mm-hmm. So if you did it again today, you would cut it down.
Well, I know what I'm doing now, but I didn't. It was the first thing I ever cut.
Right.
You know?
But you were passionate about it. Sometimes that unabashed passion.
Yes. And a lot of it was talking heads, but he interviewed all the most relevant people from the French period, Dien Bien Phu, all that, the French colonialism, the Ho Chi Minh, the whole movement, his life. I mean, there were incredible stuff in it. So it was a very important film. And that was all in New York.
It was all in New York.
And I was really depleted after that. It was a great effort, but it just felt great every day to go to. Completely. But because I had no life except the film, which is okay.
That's okay.
Because I was young.
Right.
Didn't mind.
So you finish this film, you find out to get nominated for an Academy Award, and then what?
I don't remember. I had to start working again. I worked as an assistant on commercials, I'm sure. I worked on industrials. Oh, I worked on some stuff that IBM sponsored about civil rights. I worked on little rats running through mazes for an educational film. I mean, anything I could get in New York. And it was, you know, I'd get jobs all the time.
Right.
But then another film came along that I heard about Vietnam. And it was well-funded, which D'Antonio's was not. And also, it got a little ambitious around this time because I had a film that did well, meant something I cared about, and I wanted to do more like that. And so I got on this film, Hearts and Minds, which was produced by the producer of Easy Rider, Last Picture Show, Bert Schneider.
That's cool people. Really cool.
Very cool people. The director was Peter Davis, who was a journalistic documentary filmmaker for, I think it was CBS. And he had done a very critical series called Poverty in America, because most of the people in America didn't know there was anybody poor living here.
Really?
Until that time, yeah. It was a real revelation. And it was huge. But anyway, so Peter was really brilliant. And I had a co-editor who was an old friend of Peter, Susan Martin, and me. And they shot for a year on this film.
What was the name of this picture?
It was called Hearts and Minds.
Okay, Hearts and Minds. And
it won an Academy Award.
It won an Academy Award for
Best Documentary.
So you've now edited two Academy Award nominated documentaries.
Right. Now, Hearts
both
and
about,
Minds
both
was
about Vietnam.
Right. Very different. Very different, because Hearts and Minds is more about the mentality that led America to do this and what aspects of the American character permitted it to go on to happen. It was...
Let me try and ask you, I want to ask you something, a bit of an in-depth question here. Today, with nonlinear editing, mm-hmm. with digital editing, one can unpack... try things, do things in a second.
Oh, it's fabulous.
Fabulous. Working at that time, you know, we've seen pictures, we have, you know, the bins, the takes, you know, re-editing a 5-minute scene could take upwards of a week, or sequence, you should say.
Oh, if you're lucky.
If you're right.
And you probably are going to change it again in a couple of weeks after.
So my question to you is, how you're editing this documentary, how do you, I mean, you obviously have to start somewhere.
Well, listen, they shot for over a year. They had access to every piece of stock footage there was, even more than I had because the other film was 4 years earlier. And all the networks were holding on to all their footage, and so we could access all of it.
Right.
So we had that. We had films coming in from all over. Take whatever you want. We believe in you. So we had well over a million, like 1.5 million feet of film. Finished product being 12,000, okay? Our first cut was 10 hours.
You had 1.5 million feet of film.
Yeah, yeah. So there was a lot, and they shot for a long time, too. In Vietnam, in Paris, all over the world. So it was a real task. And you know what helps in these situations is transcripts. So some of the editing is actually done on paper and then given to us, and then we have to figure out how to tell a story with these pieces.
Right.
Because, really, documentaries are the best way to learn.
Right.
You have to decide what goes in front of what for what purpose. You have to figure out character arc or story arc or... For instance, I worked on this Monsanto film about colors. Why did yellow go before red? Why did blue appear here and not green? You know, there were reasons, whatever they were. There were reasons.
Some
you could
reason.
Talk. Yeah,
right.
Some reason. There's always a reason, or you have to think twice about it, I think.
Right.
So that's what happened, and we fooled around for another, like, 16 months, 7 days a week, 20 hours a day. Higher calling, once again in a cause. And the film had been paid for by Columbia Pictures, who had done, released, you know, Paper Moon. I mean, great, Last Picture Show. Mm-hmm. Great classic movies. And they gave Bert Schneider just carte blanche do what you want. They didn't know they were getting a documentary. They didn't know they were getting an anti-war documentary. They didn't know. And when they saw it, they went berserk. And when we were at the Cannes Film Festival showing it, they actually came in before it screened and cut the logo off. And luckily, Bert Schneider had a kid in his camp cabin who was a camper, and Bert was the counselor, and they formed a lifelong friendship. And that kid was loaded. He had tons of money, and he bought the film from Columbia, and that's how it got released. It was a very exciting story.
All right, so now, I mean, by hook or by crook, some way or another, you've got yourself some serious credits at a very...
But they were documentary. But the fiction world was not...
Cutting between you and I and the rest of the world, between you and I and the rest of the world, that's a quote. Documentary is one of the toughest things to edit. I mean, you know...
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
You know, but not that an executive understands that, because, you know...
Yes.
Oh, has she cut a movie with vampires that also had aliens or it's like... These criteria are silly, right?
Right.
Have you ever suffered the brunt of that, of the criteria? Like, oh, but has she cut something with pigs in it?
Yes.
Yeah, you have?
Yeah.
Can you give me an example?
No.
No.
I don't want to go there.
Just painful?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, but I couldn't get a job. After Hearts and Minds, which for me was a little torturous, because really people's most naked moments made good film. And I remember once we were looking at some bombing footage of B-52s bombing Vietnamese towns, and we were going, oh, they didn't really hit the tents. You know, oh, they didn't kill anybody. So we were thinking that's bad footage. Do you know what I mean? And suddenly we realized, what are we talking about? You know, these are people's lives. It's all real. And there was a point at which a family had lost a son, and they really weep. And I just felt... I didn't want to do that anymore. I didn't want to have to depend on people who might not be sophisticated about documentaries to do that. I just didn't want to do it anymore. So I tried to get a job working on film, on fiction films.
Right.
And I wasn't going to do any more documentaries, because they take a year. If you sign up for one, that's it for a year.
Yeah,
year and a half. At that time, they took much longer.
Yeah. I think they still take quite a bit.
I know, they do.
Yeah, yeah.
They do.
So,
I got a job for Milos Forman. I mean, I got this job on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Pinched me. It took a year.
Till you got the job? Or
till I found a job where they would hire me.
So how many did you interview for?
How many did I interview for?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
Dozens?
I don't remember.
You don't remember?
It would be, you don't know how to cut a story.
Right. Oh, you don't know how to cut a story? Oh, well, that's good.
You're not experienced in this.
Right.
Yeah.
So Milos Forman, one of the greatest filmmakers ever.
Yes.
Of all time, gives you a job.
And I'll tell you how I got the job.
Yes.
Interview.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm working on Hearts and Minds for this unbelievably successful producer, Bert Schneider, who has his own sound editor, who's the best. And Bert said, we're going to give you this sound editor, Jim Nelson, who's going to do the sound for your mix. And I'm thinking, because I've never worked with a sound editor before. I've always done my own sound editing.
Oh, what? Interesting.
He doesn't love the film. He doesn't care. He doesn't know. How can he do the work? It was infuriating to me. And so the night before the mix, as usual, as always, I'm up all night getting the right sound. I mean, I've been working on it for a long time. And the next day, we walk into the mix, and this Hollywood guy comes with, now at this time, it was all on mag tracks.
Yeah.
And they were on reels.
Yeah.
And he came with, like, I don't know, 150 reels, and they were hanging them, they called it, all over this back room where they keep all the, and threading them up. And each was a different sound level to make a B-52 bomber. And I come in with my one reel, and in fact it was on 16 millimeter, my soundtrack. This is the real thing. And I'll tell you, after 10 minutes, I realized I was so outclassed. I was so wrong. This guy's B-52 sounded like an airplane, and mine just sounded like junk, even though it was the real thing. I mean, who knows where it was recorded even.
Right.
I mean, sound guys really bring a lot to the table. That's what I understood.
Yes.
Anyway, one day he got a call from his next door neighbor.
Yes.
Who was saying, I'm making this movie up here in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I need a cheap editor. You got any suggestions?
Yeah.
So he said, well, I worked with this girl, this woman. I don't think he would have said woman at that time. But anyway, so that was Michael Douglas, was the next door neighbor. And I flew up and I met Michael and then I met Milos and Richard Chu was the editor on it already. And it was like the magic job of my dreams. I had loved all of Milos' films. I'd seen everything he did in Czechoslovakia. I saw the film he did in Taking Off, which he had done in New York. And I thought, I want to work for this guy when I saw it. I kind of got excited about editing. So I was thrilled. Mm-hmm. And I loved working on it. And there were three of us editing.
The three of you editing. It was you.
Richard Chu, who was the first editor.
Yeah.
Me, and then Sheldon Kahn. And,
no relation to Michael.
No relation to Michael.
Right.
No.
And so you're cutting One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
How long of a process was that?
Well, there was no cutting down while they were shooting. Milos didn't want anyone touching his film.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he would hang out mostly with Richard and then come around to my room and Shelley's room. I think it took about 5-6 months. I really don't remember.
How did you break
until the mix?
How did you break up the editorial?
Well, I started out doing the things like the meeting with Dr. Spivey.
Yep.
Group things that were
wonderful scenes, by the way.
Not the group therapy.
No. I mean, just the across the desk.
Yeah.
Well,
and with Jack and him, but also with the other shrinks discussing whether he's mentally ill or not.
Right.
I mean, stuff like that, because that was more documentary. But then I started doing, the basketball game. You know, stuff like that.
Right.
But then I started doing other
stuff.
So
did you actually cut the basketball game when the chief walks over slowly and sort of drops it in, and then he slowly sort of gets into the game? That was all you?
I don't think it was all me.
But
I think there were, I can't remember.
It's okay.
I know I did quite a bit of it.
It's a beautiful sequence.
It's a beautiful movie.
The whole movie's beautiful, but I'm just...
I was very happy on that movie.
Right. What did you pick up from cutting One Flew Over the Cuckoo's
Nest? Well, Milos is a fantastic person in an editing room, and his voice is always in my mind, you know. Just what you can do and what you can't do. Try it. Try this. Try that. Which I always did anyway. Try everything. He wanted to see everything. Got an idea? Make it work. If you can't, keep trying. And then when I would make a mistake, and he was in the room seeing it, he'd go, oh. And for the rest of my life, when I would make a mistake in editing, I mean, just a technical mistake.
Right.
I'd hear that, oh, get real impatient with myself. You know, he would say, oh, that'll never work. Oh, it's nice. It's good. I mean, he was just a pleasure to work with. Try this. Look at this. This frame to this frame. What do you think? And he would be, yeah, what about that frame to that frame? Okay, try it. Show me. He was open. But he had a lot of ideas. And it was a pleasure to work with him. I did two other films with him.
Talk about editing the performances or cutting the performances of both Nicholson and also, and I'm sorry.
Oh, Louis.
Yes.
They're wonderful actors.
Louis Fletcher, right.
They were wonderful.
Yeah.
It wasn't hard.
What's hard
is when they're not wonderful.
Right.
That's hard.
But literally the performance of Nurse Ratched just...
They were there.
It just came out.
It was there in all the dailies. They were consummate actors.
Amazing.
I mean, I'd like to take credit for shaping that performance of Jack's, but I can't.
as far as things, light bulbs that went off during the process of editing that, because you mentioned this tracking shot in the commercial onto the ladder, and you know you had a light bulb go off that I need to see what other people are looking at. What were some of the light bulbs that went off outside of the experimentation? Try this, try that. Was there any particular sequence in the movie that wasn't working?
Yeah, there were a bunch.
That all of a sudden, when you just did this, it started to work.
Yeah. Well, there was one where Jack is meeting the Indian for the first time. And he's looking up at him and he's trying to get him to talk. And then he turns. And then he appears in another shot, and there was no way to get him to move across. There was just no way to bridge that moment that made sense. I mean, I'm sure we could have gone to another character, but so everybody, you know, Milosh was in despair, and here's how I got to be really high in his eyes. I looked through all the footage, and at one point he said, cut, and Jack looked at him and then just walked toward the camera and past the camera.
Before that, I actually stopped rolling film. So you took it from that.
Documentary. Use anything.
High five.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a trick that a lot of people, you know, don't look for, you know. And I've heard that's a similar story to that from other people, you know. Like, doesn't take away the genius of what you did. I'm just saying that, you know,
it doesn't take away from anybody else's genius either.
That's what I'm saying.
I want to make clear, it wasn't like I saved the movie. It was a very good film.
No.
And the other editors were very good also.
I have no doubt that was your shining moment. Or one of them.
That was a nice moment for me.
Yeah. Was there other moments like that?
Oh, thousands. But I can't recount them. No, I mean, you know, every day you do things that blow your mind, that blow your director's mind. That's what you like to do, is make things work. Right. That's what we do all the time.
Was the ending of the movie always meant to be the ending the way it sets?
Yeah.
Just Chief sort of running
off?
Yeah,
now I worked on the ending, and it was good. And then I started playing with the arrangement of shots one day, putting this shot in front of this instead of after this, and just playing with them. And at some point, Milosh walked in, and he looked, and he said, that's it. It's great. The movie works. If the end works, the movie works. That's it. So that was...
And you guys never changed another frame?
We didn't change that, no. But what happened, this is very interesting, was you know how the Indian runs?
Yes.
Now that shot was lost in the laboratory. They didn't find the negative. They couldn't find the negative.
So you had to pull it
and
from
that
the
shot was always, you know, going to be the titles. It was a very long shot in terms of how long it lasted. And yeah, it's the work picture. And
actually had to pull it from the print. You had to pull a deep neg from the print.
And they couldn't do what they could do today.
Right.
I'm sure they have on the CDs now. I haven't looked at a recent one. But at that time, you could kind of, if you were a hip at all to filmmaking, you could kind of see it was a little different quality than the rest of the movie.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought it was always a choice.
Were you aware of that?
A little bit. I mean, it looks a little darker, and a little mushy or grainy or whatever, you know. But
no, that wasn't
the
choice.
Now that you mention it, that's really funny. I mean, you don't notice it because emotionally, like, it's so well edited, if I may say so, you're sutured to the story. You don't care. But I've seen the movie enough times to...
Yeah,
you know. Let's talk a little bit about the third act of the movie before.
You know, it was a very long time ago.
Yeah, but your memory is better than you give yourself credit for.
Okay.
So don't mess. I'm kidding. You know, there's this sequence before Nosferatu comes in and busts them, and the strangulation and the fight between them and everything. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And it's kind of this cacophony. There's a few cacophonic sort of, they're not clumsy in any way. They sort of feel very loose, like the group sessions.
Yeah.
Hit me, you know, the card games, whatever, you know, like that stuff, right? But that party sequence where it's Brad, what's his name?
Dourif.
Giving a standing performance as well. Brad, you know, just... Everything that's happening. How did you guys as an editorial team know how to make it feel like so relaxed? Because it's 70s filmmaking. It's like it's so like free and you know.
Milosh.
It was all Milosh.
Milosh.
And it still is compelling. It holds you the whole time, but you'd have a hard time figuring out why. You know, if you're asking yourself the question. And it's something that happened in the 60s and 70s, and you don't really see again today. It's tough to find.
Milosh Forman, ladies and gentlemen. No. He knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
He didn't always know exactly how to get there, but he knew how to shoot, to cut, to get what he wanted.
So you edited, you co-edited one of the three movies that has ever won all five major Academy Awards. The other two being,
I don't know,
It Happened One Night and 1934 and Silence of the Lambs. What was the next major project for you?
I did some minor projects at the time. The next major one was Hair, which I also did with Milos.
Oh, yeah. Musical?
I love the music. Love the music.
Treat Williams?
Treat.
Tell us about it.
Oh, it was just the most fun to work on. I love Milos. I love New York. I love the work. Mirek Andrzejczyk was the cameraman. Miroslav Andrzejczyk. It's so beautiful. It's such a beautiful looking movie. There were problems with this. I don't know, but
what were the problems? The story.
Well, it seems a little dated today.
Yeah.
The story was a bit of a. It wasn't compelling. It just didn't click, and I recently saw it again, and I could see why. But
why?
I'm not going there.
Really?
It's not the editing. Well, we had a better cut, by the way, on that.
Yeah.
We had a better cut, I thought, but we couldn't stop cutting. They just let us, and we continued cutting.
Oh, you're saying
it's almost like a disease. I'm not saying we damaged it in the cutting room. No.
No. You're saying why it wasn't compelling for another reason.
There were different factors. Personally, I was looking at it, was a little disappointed, and say, I can't go there.
Okay.
I can't go there.
Okay. I understand. I think sometimes there's a fine line between insulting somebody else and just sort of identifying what you think could have made the movie better. But
right.
I understand if you don't want to go there.
Right. Treat was great. Milos was great. Andrzejczyk was brilliant. Brilliant.
Right.
New York was so beautiful. Central Park was gorgeous.
Yes, it is a beautiful movie.
And it was a joy to work on. Because of the music. Musicals are fun to work on,
but
if you like the music.
You're saying you think you actually had a better cut.
Well, we had a better cut, but it sort of doesn't matter.
Wouldn't
have changed.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes a better cut will change the film 5%, 2%. It wasn't right. It wouldn't have saved the movie.
Right.
It's just there were some numbers that were very beautiful, long. That were not beautiful, short. But
it's funny. You may, I don't know, this may not be your taste, but I remember I saw Natural Born Killers in the theater, which was the studio cut, and then when I saw, and I thought it was so overly violent, I couldn't really get into it. Then when I saw the director's cut, that was about 30% more indulgent, I thought it was glorious. It's like one of these things where sometimes there are things that are better oversaturated than cut down.
Yeah, it wasn't oversaturated. It was just too long.
Right.
It wasn't taking out violence or anything. It was just
I was just relating the one to the other.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to your... Let me just go back to your wonderful resume here. Okay, so we have to talk about... First of all, Baby Boom. We got to talk about Baby Boom.
That was really hard to cut because of the baby. That was really hard to cut. I remember thinking, I deserve an Academy Award for this bit. It was so hard to cut because of the baby, but it was fun.
Right. Story about, just tell us the story of Baby Boom again.
The story was Diane Keaton is a very hardworking executive in New York, busy life, and she inherits a baby from a cousin who has died, and there's no one else but Diane Keaton to take care of the baby. And she tries to run her life having everything, having the baby and having her high-powered job. And that gets very hard, and she moves to Vermont. It was very much of the time, very funny, though. The writers were very good, Nancy Myers and Charles Shire. Good writers.
Mm-hmm. This movie, everybody over the age of 25 saw this movie.
Good.
I remember my parents going to watch it. I was quite young at the time, but, you know, everybody saw this movie and loved it. How many babies did you shoot with?
Well, there were two. They were twins. That's what they do.
Oh, they got twins.
And there was a happier baby and a crying baby. it would alternate. But you could, they wouldn't act on cue, ever. And continuity.
Freaking babies, huh?
You know, they would drop the bottle on this line, they would drop the bottle on that line. You had to be in a wide shot or in a medium shot, and you had to see the bottle, so you had to...
Did you ever phone up the set and tell get those babies freaking acting normally?
Yeah. No.
No? No? Okay. Because I'd be pretty upset about the babies not acting.
There were babies.
There were babies.
My problem.
You edited two movies for Danny DeVito.
I think more.
Okay. Sorry. Only three.
The first one was War of the Roses, which yes. Michael Douglas produced,
right.
by the way.
Right, and they were roommates at one point.
They're best friends. They're best friends, buddies.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, they're buddies. And I remember seeing them interviewed on the show. So let's talk about the War of the Roses. This movie is deceptively compelling. Like, it starts off, and it's kind of a disaster in slow motion. And you keep on wondering if it's going to get better. And it kind of never does. It's a cautionary tale.
It's a cautionary tale.
And wonderful sequences that we cut back to with this narrator, sort of a semi-narrator, played by Danny DeVito himself as the lawyer giving the lesson to the guy who just came into his family law practice to say, this is what happens if you get divorced. What was the challenge in terms of the chemistry between, it was Kathleen Turner, right? Kathleen Turner, Michael Douglas, what was the challenges there in the chemistry between them or trying to?
Well, they were, again, very good actors. Yeah. You know, and they played people who, like my parents, were in a war against each other.
Right.
And they weren't kidding. You know, with wonderful actors, you just have your choice of wonderful things to use.
Right.
I wouldn't say there was a struggle there.
Right. Was there a concern at any point when you were... I'm assuming you tested the movie.
Yeah.
Was there a concern at any point that this was like people were just not going to like this?
Well, there's one thing. Okay, there was one scene where she played a gourmet cook.
Yeah.
In fact, I think she was a caterer in the movie.
Yeah.
And she was having a big feast... And she finds out that her husband, Michael Douglas, has accidentally, although she doesn't see it as accidentally, run over her cat while he was backing out of a driveway.
Right. He is the dog, she is the cat.
Right.
Right.
So time passes, they do bad things to one another, taking turns. And she invites him to dinner, that she's going to cook this great dinner for him. And he's all excited because he thinks, well, maybe she'll give him the house now. They're fighting over the house. Who's going to have the house? And so she makes this elaborate thing, and she makes some pate. And they're talking, and at one point she says, have some pate. And he eats it, and he says, this is delicious. What is it? And she goes, woof, woof.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Okay, like... He's eating his dog. And then we had a shot of the dog running by the back. So you knew she didn't really kill the dog. That wasn't really the dog. But we did try it a couple times without the dog.
Meaning that he was eating his dog.
Yeah. Meaning there was no reason to believe it wasn't his dog. And it tested badly. So we put the dog back in.
You're saying dog killing just crossed the line.
That crossed the line.
Surprising.
Can't kill the dog.
Can't kill the dog.
Right.
Well, that's a great story. The ending of the movie, I saw it in the theater. There's this very ambiguous moment. I think Michael Douglas leans in and says, throughout all this, I've loved you, and I know you've loved me too. And she kind of goes, eh, or something like that, and then knocks his hand off or something, and they both
die. She didn't love him.
She didn't love him.
No.
Right. So was there testing playing that differently, the response differently?
Yeah, well, the studio came by and said, what if they live? They wanted to change the ending, no happy ending. Consider it, they said.
How did that fly?
Not very well. It was dismissed right away.
Dismissed right away.
And the producer also, Michael Douglas was one of the producers, and Jim Brooks was one of the producers.
Right.
They were a tough crew.
And they just stood there and said, no, not happening on this movie. Take your happy ending and shove it. Right.
I don't think they put it that way.
but something of that nature.
It was all done very politely, but it was very predictable.
Right. Is there any other challenging moments cutting that movie that you can remember?
Oh, a million. It was a tough movie to cut. First of all, there was tons and tons of wonderful footage, but you had to get it all to fit together. So there was that, and then there were sequences that were... the first cut was absolutely perfect. It played beautifully. I even had a music editor and a sound editor to work with, and when we showed it, Danny was like, oh my God, this is just the greatest. But it was 3.5 hours.
3.5 hours?
Yeah, it was over 3 hours, yeah, and we had to cut it down. And that was the hardest thing.
Because it played really well at 3 hours.
Yeah, but you couldn't do that. We know that. Couldn't do that. So that was tough. And getting it right. So if you take this out, you have to take that out and move this here, then that's not going to work.
I'm having a hard time imagining what the extra sequences were in the 3.5 hours.
Oh, he had some shots that were... There was one that I just loved so much where they're in the bedroom, and the camera, and it was on a balcony, and he was sleeping like in a room over here, I think. I can't really remember exactly, but it was... She kind of goes to his door and begins to knock and then doesn't and moves back. And then it was choreographed so beautifully. It was about 10 minutes, but it held. It held.
Compelling.
Compelling. And it actually didn't make the movie seem too long. It was just great, and we had to cut it out. You know, stuff like that happens all the time.
Of course.
In Hair, there was a shot. One day I was sitting in the cutting room with Mila, and we stopped on a shot that had been shot in the desert, and it was so beautiful. It was the tribe sitting there in the leaves of the trees. It was sort of pink and beige and warm. And Mila said, isn't that beautiful? I said, yeah, it's really beautiful. He said, it's too beautiful. Take it out. Stops the movie.
Fantastic. So let's talk about the next, I think it was the next movie you made with Danny DeVito, which was Hoffa.
Yeah.
Okay.
I did A River Runs Through It before that with Robert Redford.
With Robert Redford, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about A River Runs Through It.
Yeah, that was beautiful too.
Yeah.
Philip Russolo.
Russolo, the cinematographer.
Yeah.
Philippe, yeah.
Is it beautiful. Yeah. French, Philippe.
Yes. One of the best cinematographers in the world.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And tell us if you can relate the story of River Runs Through It, obviously based on a great
novel. Well, it's a true story. It's based on a true story in a Montana classic about two brothers who were very close. Their father was a minister, and they were brought up fishing, fly fishing. It was the big event, the major religious event in their life, although their father was a preacher. There was something about fly fishing to this family, to the men in the family. It was very important. And as time passed, one of the brothers kind of goes astray. That's basically what the story is. And it was beautifully shot and beautifully directed. 14 months.
Of cutting?
Yeah.
Lots of very long first cut there as well?
We try everything.
Right.
They tried everything, which is great. I love it.
You've seen trends come and go in editing.
Like
over
what?
The years. Really fast cutting.
You know, oh, yeah.
I mean, you've seen...
It's still happening all the time.
Right. How do you feel about... I mean, do you ever see something and you go, I can't keep up with that as a viewer?
I think... A lot of films should have that cutting, so I don't have a quarrel with that kind of cutting. What drives me crazy is a car chase where you don't know where anybody is or who anybody is. Two white cars, say. And there are just lots of cuts of cars going and the driver's going, and you don't know the relationship between them. That drives me nuts. Chases that aren't...
Point to point to point.
Well, no, I don't mean point to point, but just that you have to have some sort of sense of what's going on. And sometimes I feel like the shots were thrown up in the air and then assembled. That's what, occasionally.
What about fist fights?
Yeah. That too. No, fist fights, usually I know better what's going on. I don't tend to see movies that are really... big fist fight movies.
Right. Like, you don't actually go to the theater to watch them.
No. No.
Let's talk about A River Runs Through It for a second. Is there any particular sequence in the movie that, you know, you really, really love the way it sort of...
I loved it all. I love the beginning where it's Redford's beautiful voice reading from the book about how his father taught him fly fishing. Oh, and the little boy who plays the older brother as a little boy is
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah.
In the movie. And I thought he was great then. He was like 9, 8.
Yeah.
Maybe younger. How he teaches fly fishing. I love that. It's just the rhythm of his voice and of the place and the sounds and the whole rhythm of their life in the when they're young and how his father would make him rewrite everything he wrote. You know, now do it better. He'd hand him his homework and father would say, very good, now do it better. Always. It was never good enough. Just the whole life there, I loved it.
That's
this
great.
Isn't saying a lot.
No.
It was just the first third of the movie I was completely enraptured with. And remember better is all.
You remember the first third of the movie. Well, it's because it builds such a good...
I mean, setup. I remember the movie.
Yeah. No, but you're saying the first act is the part that you're in love with a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
So, Hoffa.
Yeah.
If we can talk about Hoffa. My understanding is that this production-wise is very challenged.
In what way?
That it sort of doubled the schedule or went over schedule, went long over budget.
There was too big a budget, right, in my opinion.
And it is, again, flashing forward and back drama where we're cutting between Jack Nicholson playing Jimmy Hoffa and Danny DeVito playing his cohort, waiting at a roadside diner while we flash back through the whole times where they met. A very epic drama.
It was an epic drama. What was unfortunate was that people didn't know who Jimmy Hoffa was. And they didn't know how to follow the development of who he was in relation to what he was doing through the film. So the film goes over a long period of time. And, Jimmy Hoffa did amazing things for the Teamsters. They were making a fortune. They still are, I believe. It was one of the strongest unions in the country.
It still is, yeah.
So, but we didn't get that information in the film, and I think that really harmed it.
Was this a lot of discussions between you and Danny about what you felt was needed in there?
No.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it was not an idea that anybody would respond to.
Right. So you're saying the essential part...
I mean, I remember, I came on late on that, and I remember seeing it and mentioning that maybe we should go to some newsreels and stuff. But what happened was really that was not taken up, and in truth, I got caught up in the director's vision, and I never pushed it. And there was another unfortunate mistake on that, which was we didn't have previews. War of the Roses was such an enormous hit that he had a loose rein on him for Hoffa.
And it cost.
Perhaps. I'm sorry we didn't have previews because they're horrible. They're horrible. But you find out stuff like no one knows who the guy is, who the movie's about. The way, you know, I grew up hearing about Jimmy Hoffa because he was in the news all the time. But a lot of people younger than us didn't have a clue.
So if you're trying to summarize what the structural problem with the movie was that the movie didn't actually explain what he had done, like almost on a professional level.
Where he was in his life, where he was professionally, what he had done for the men. That's why they were so behind him. He had really done amazing things for their standard of living, for their lives. And he was getting corrupt, and how he got corrupt, and why he did, and how that began to come out. And then the whole relationship with the Kennedys, which is almost not understandable, really, Bobby Kennedy's hatred of him. but it was definitely a factor of both their lives, that right. antagonism.
There's one sequence I wanted to ask you about because, again, it's just it stood out in my mind when I watched it. The hunting sequence.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That was shot on a stage?
I think it was.
I think it was. Was there ever a discussion about...
how it looked?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was.
And what was it just...
I'm sorry, I just don't remember.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
It looked, yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting sequence. It looked like it's on the stage, and I always thought, you know, was that something that that maybe was discussed to go back and reshoot, you know, in the woods, but I didn't, you know.
I think we talked about that.
Yeah.
And it certainly everybody was aware of that.
Mm-hmm. But you had to draw a line somewhere.
I don't remember,
right.
Really. It must have been budget, is all I could think.
Right. A glorious little film. I shouldn't say little. A glorious film, Matilda. Perhaps overlooked at the box office, I don't know, but I think you can show this movie anytime, any day, to any kid of a certain age, whether it's now, 20 years from now, or 20 years ago, and it just plays wonderfully.
Wonderfully.
And it has such a remarkable sense. I mean, if War of the Roses was this kind of, for Danny DeVito, this kind of very, I don't want to say sterile, but this very dark drama, very dark, sort of like slightly stylized drama, and Hoffa was this epic drama, this is almost like there are moments where the camera use, the wide-angle lenses, is so almost cartoony, and it's playful, and it still builds like this wonderful tension between, you know, it rides the line between creating an antagonist in the principal that they're so scared of, and the character of the kids, and making everything sort of work together. It's just a wonderful movie. It's a wonderful movie from beginning to end. Can you tell me about cutting that movie? I mean,
how lucky were we? Yeah. First of all, I want to say that Danny, in every movie I've worked with him on, it's just amazing visual sense of how to use the camera.
Right.
War of the Roses, which was the first film I worked with him, and Hoffa, there's some great,
beautiful,
unimaginably interesting, smart, gorgeous, appropriate camera moves, design, choreography of the camera, and every film he does. And he shoots a lot, which I love as an editor.
Oh, you like getting a lot of footage.
I love a lot of angles. I love it, especially when they're good.
Right.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a little torturous. Should we go here or there or there or there? But, yeah.
but he tends to shoot things from a lot of different angles.
Yeah. Yeah. As did Milosh.
Right.
Yeah.
And for Matilda, like, you know, any particular sequence that, you know, sort of came
out? Oh, all of them. I love the chocolate cake.
What's the kid's name again?
I don't remember.
I forget what the kid's name is.
Me too.
They're chanting it, though, you know. Eat it.
I just thought a lot of it was just great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is the sequence towards the end again about the house? Some magic bit about the house. I forget. Was it a chase around the house? I think they're trying to avoid.
They were hiding from her.
Right. I love Matilda. I think it's a wonderful movie.
Me too.
Yeah. Was it sort of one of these films that because it was just so fun to cut that it sort of had a little bit of a, it took the ease off of it because it was just, you know, fun to cut?
What do you mean?
Like I'm saying, compared to say cutting something with a lot of heavy drama on it, this has a little more playfulness to it.
No, I don't think that. It was fun to cut because Danny's fun. He's fun to be with. He's one of those people, just makes me laugh all the time. And I had a great crew, and we had a wonderful time doing it.
Are you starting to cut on...
I don't think it matters whether you're cutting a drama or... I don't think the content of the film matters that much.
Right.
You know, you live in that film. Except the Vietnam stuff was a little different. But that's documentaries. What am I talking about? We're talking about
You answered my question beautifully.
Whether a sad movie will make you sad, or a happy movie will make you happy. And you can be in torture over a happy movie if it's not cutting well, or if it doesn't work, or if somebody doesn't get it, you know, comedy, and nobody laughs. You know, it can be just as torturous as any heartbreaking drama.
At this point, are you starting to cut?
No.
Digitally?
No.
No, not yet?
It wasn't here for a long time.
Still flatbed?
I think it was after Matilda, actually.
We cut City of Angels.
Yeah.
That must have been tough to cut.
Why do you say that?
Well, just because it's this kind of like drama set in Los Angeles in the cage. And
yeah, it was 16 months, 15, 14. It was a long one.
What was the first digital suite you worked on? Or non-linear, whatever you want.
I worked on Lightworks.
You worked on Lightworks first, okay.
What happened, you know, every now and then there would be a machine would be invented and everyone would say, oh, this is it. And they were usually video. And they were usually unusable. And sometimes television would use them, but I sort of thought it's never going to happen in film, and it made me okay, because I could toss that film around like the best of them. You know, I mean, I had many, many years of experience and dexterity, and there was a lot you needed to know when we were working with film that you don't need to know now.
Right.
Which I learned through doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, my assistant from, maybe it was War of the Roses, anyway, he called up one day and he said, you've got to come over here. This is the machine. It's going to sweep the world. And I think it was an Avid, actually. And I went over there and I saw it and he worked it and I thought, he's right. It's really going to change everything. And within a year or two, it was like wildfire. It was like sound must have been. That quick. Everything changed. Everything.
And was there an adjustment process for you?
For me, it was a long, long process, yeah. Because, well, I learned on a Lightworks, which is a wonderful machine, very much like an Avid, but a little different, a little more elegant. And I never really was taught. Someone demonstrated it, but never taught me, and bam, I was right on a film.
Which one?
This was Outbreak.
Yep.
And
which I saw on the drive-in, actually.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I've never been as speedy as some people on these machines, but I'm speedy enough for me. It's a tool. That's the way I see it. It's a tool. But people go like this, and I don't think that fast. So
you like to put in some thought and time before you pick?
No. I mean, but I think about it all the time. Yeah,
right.
I always.
Do you like to?
It's so much better.
Yeah.
This is what I have to say. Okay, so I don't know what year Outbreak was in. What year was it?
Outbreak, I believe, was in 95, yeah.
95. So it's a long time of working with Moviola and then with the Chem and Steinbeck. And suddenly this technology comes along that makes it so much more fun to edit. For one thing, you didn't have to worry about sync all the time because it was in sync. For another, if you wanted to try something, now if I'm working on a movie, let's say Cuckoo's Nest, and we have a pretty good cut of the scene, but what if we tried it over here instead of that shot, we used that very long shot and then went to, we'd be changing the whole thing, but this works, so we'd send it to the lab. And the lab would take a day to print a dupe and get it back to us. We'd send it to the sound house for the sound. So we always had the old version. And then we would start cutting. And it was in black and white, by the way. Dupes were always in black and white at that time. And
you were cutting everything in black and white?
No, the dupes.
The dupes.
I mean, just that's a side thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter.
Right.
And with digital, what was amazing is you can try something, and then if it doesn't work, you just press undo about 10 times, and you're back where you started. Or you can have a whole section of the film. Let's rearrange this, put this here, that there, and this there. So you just go Apple S, and you've saved what you have, and then you can do whatever you want, and it's there. what you had before. It's so ridiculously wonderful.
Right.
Plus, it's much easier to have a lot of soundtracks and music tracks, which right. we didn't have
right.
on the cams, because there were only four or at the most six. You know, there just wasn't that much room to have it, and it was too bulky. So you never had more than two tracks, really.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe three.
Outbreak.
What about it?
The monkey getting shot.
Yeah.
Was that a trick? Did they have the footage? Was it special effects? You don't remember
I didn't
that.
Work on that part. There were three or four editors.
Oh, there were three or four editors? What were you brought in to do on Outbreak?
Well, I was starting it because the editor that he wanted to use, Neil Travis, was working on something. And so it was great. So I started.
So you just throw things together and get them going?
No, I worked hard at throwing things together, but yeah. I was having trouble with the machines.
Oh, with the machines.
Yeah, right. But that film was interesting because it was a film about a virus getting out.
And it was ahead of its time, actually, because there's like been 30 movies since.
Right, that was the first, I think.
It was, yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe there was a Michael Crichton one. But anyway.
I remember it.
But at that time,
three.
There were two yeah. announced at the same time by two different studios.
Yeah.
There was this one, and there was another one at Fox with Jodie Foster and Michael Douglas. So there were the two, and they were neck and neck. And they Warner Brothers, this was from Warner Brothers, they just went into production before the script was finished. They just went into production. The other one dropped out. And there they were with a whole crew in Eureka or someplace, California, with army trucks and troops. And so while they wrote, they just would do endless shots of army trucks going right, left, going left, right, going tighter, right, left, left. You know, and I thought, well, they could always release this as a sleeping mechanism. Because also they were MOS, of course.
Right.
Okay, we're stopping?
No, no, we're just restarting.
Oh, you know, I would love to stop.
Sure.
Have some more water.
Sure, by all means.
I would love to take off the sweater, but I think I'd mess up the continuity.
No, don't. Go ahead. Go ahead. What do we care about continuity? Continuity is for suckers.
Okay. I've never really talked about all these films. You know that?
I think it's great.
This is.
You worked on so many great ones.
Oh, it's the mic. I forgot what it was. Uh-oh. Is that a bug? Piece of jewelry? Yeah, I don't remember a lot of stuff.
Continuity's got to be far down. I mean, do you subscribe to what Walter wrote in his book? I mean,
Did he write?
Well, you know, how about how continuity's far down the list of what really is most important? Like, the first thing he wants is the emotion of the scene.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Performance.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But development. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You mean continuity, what matches?
Well, yeah.
If it's good enough, nobody's going to notice.
Right.
That's
right.
Yeah. Can I ask a question while we're waiting?
Yeah.
Since we're waiting for Emily to flush.
Mm-hmm.
Working with Danny DeVito,
mm-hmm.
is he different when you're cutting a scene he's in than when you're cutting a scene he's mm-hmm. not in? He doesn't have any kind of like ego about, I'd rather have this take because my face.
Well,
or
it's very hard when you're working with an actor who's a director to say, we don't need this scene. But he's pretty good about that. It's hard, though.
Yeah.
No, he's a great guy. He's one of the most lovely people I know. His whole family. And his wife, Rhea, was in the movie and played the wife.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they're just wonderful people. Great kids.
Mm-hmm.
And very funny. That's the most important thing for me. I have to have a laugh every day or I get very unhappy. I have comedies on my VCR, on my TiVo, for that purpose. If my husband hasn't cracked a joke or if I haven't had any laughs, I have to
then
turn
you got it.
Modern Family or 40 Rock, 30 Rock always doesn't do it for me.
I like 40 Rock.
It's 30 Rock, right?
Yeah, oh. It's just like that Modern Family or that 40 Rock. Your kids with your long hair.
Yeah.
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 Okay, so Man on the Moon also with Milos.
Yeah.
That's an interesting picture because of the ending.
What was the ending?
Well, the ending is that we say, it says that Andy basically dies, And we have the scene of him sort of like, you know, on his deathbed. It's getting pretty morbid at that point. And then I just realized you didn't...
Oh, the Tony reappearance.
Yeah, the reappearance of Tony.
That was all true.
What do you mean that was all true? He was dead.
Well, we think it was Zamuda who did Tony then. Bob Zamuda, who was played by Paul Giamatti.
Right.
The weird thing is that I knew Andy.
You knew Andy Kaufman?
He was really close with my brothers.
How did that come about?
They went to school together, grade school.
Was he always that far out?
Yeah, he was pretty far out. Yeah, he was.
So
when he died, my brother, because he never smoked, they said he died of lung cancer. My brother couldn't believe it. So he kept thinking it was a joke, and there was a...
Oh, he never smoked?
No, he never smoked. He was very healthy. He was very health-oriented. He meditated. He ate. He was a vegetarian. He was very healthy. No, he never smoked.
So then he dies...
Of lung cancer.
Of lung cancer.
Very young.
And then Tony reappeared where?
I think in a nightclub in New Jersey or something. I have it mixed up in my mind with the real stuff. So
right. But it's a fascinating sequence to put in at the end of the movie. Because the movie is building this... it's a biopic. You know,
what year was... How many years ago was that?
Man of the Moon, 99.
Okay.
14 years.
Okay.
But there's this biopic that's building, and then all of a sudden it ends the movie with, huh? And all the characters, like all the it's almost like a credit sequence, like all the.
Are we recording this?
Yeah.
Oh.
All the cast characters are there, watching. You know what I'm saying? It's just.
I don't remember. I'm sorry. I don't remember the end
okay
of the movie.
Earlier when I was.
We must have tried a lot of stuff, and I must say I don't remember.
That's okay.
So.
That's okay. But it was a great. It's a great movie. Man on the Moon.
You know, it's funny. You want to tell stories, but you don't want to tell stories out of school. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you can.
So I'm not going to.
Okay. But if you want to tell a story out of school, you can. It's up to you. We will use posterity in terms of okay. Ollie.
Oh, well, that was very interesting.
Michael Mann.
Michael Mann.
Now, were you the only editor on
it? No,
okay.
No, I was one of many, many.
Now, he shoots a ton of footage, right?
As opposed to who? They all shoot a ton of footage. Michael shoots a lot, though. Yeah.
Okay.
But I like that. I don't mind that.
We're putting that in the cut, by the way. As opposed to who, Jeff? As opposed to who? So, yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of directors shoot... I've worked with a lot of directors that shoot a lot of film.
Right.
And I love that.
Right. And Ollie comes in, and I'm assuming it, you know, how do you organize the order of events of what you're going to show about Muhammad Ali here?
Well, you know, it was a very long script, and it was very all-encompassing. And when we started out, I was cutting most of the relationship stuff. Billy... he just won the Academy Award for editing. He's a great guy. I love
Billy
him.
Billy Goldenberg?
Thank you. So Billy Goldenberg was the main editor. He had worked with Michael before. And I did some of the relationship stuff. And there was another editor on who had done commercials who was hired at that time to do fights. So that's how it broke down. But Michael was away for 6 months, I guess, shooting. And we were cutting. And we get very specific notes.
From Michael,
which was very, very hard for me to do. And I had actually talked to him about working on a previous film of his. And when he showed me the notes, I thought, I can't do this.
Why?
Because the director's not there. They may like that take for one reason, but I may not be able to cut that take in on every line or I find better lines. I mean, I go from what I see from the film. We change it all the time. But if I want to make this scene work and I can't do it with that take, I'm still going to make the scene work with another take. So when people start giving me detailed, use this take, this take, this take, it gets me a little crazy.
Right.
Better, I should show them what works.
Right. So this actually goes to something principally about the craft of editing, which is something I talked about other editors trying to communicate to anybody watching this who wants to understand is that, you know, people think, oh, you know, on this take you nailed it, but, you know, and this is the, you know, take three is the good take, whereas takes one and two are bad.
Well, but there may be some...
When you start putting it into context of whatever the rhythm and flow of the scene is, it may very well be that the worst take is the best take, because...
Well, I don't think the worst take is the best take.
I'm just saying, yeah.
But sometimes there is a golden moment in a take. There's no question.
Yeah.
That, they got it. They got it. They nailed it. Right. But the other lines, or the other moments, so you have to build to that moment. But usually, a director's going to take 4 to 10 takes, there's a reason why. And that was because something wasn't right with each one. So, and then you have all those options. Why not explore them? That's what I feel. So,
how tough was it to squeeze Ollie down to the runtime that ended up being inevitably?
Well, it's rare that you squeeze it down. It's more that you start here and build it.
Right.
You know, when people say, oh, you take stuff out. No, no, I put stuff in. I construct. It's kind of, you know, you build it. You make it.
Apparently in Australia, they don't call it a cut. They call it a join. I found that interesting.
I find that interesting, too.
Yeah. I thought you'd like that.
Yeah, I like that.
Said. And I think, I forget which Russian filmmaker, films aren't shot, they're built.
Well, in a way they are.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a more elegant word for that, I'm sure, but I'm not thinking of it right now. Crafted. Because you have so many options in a cutting room. You have all those takes, all those lines, plus you can loop some lines, you can dub some other lines, you can use music, you can change the atmosphere with the sound, and these days, you can change what's out the window. It's nothing. It's just so plastic a medium. More so every day with the digital.
I love your passion for it. Do you love what you do?
Yeah, I do. I love what I do.
Have you had a lot of time off over the years, or you're pretty much constantly
Well, I
working?
Have kids.
Right.
And I have a husband who works in film also.
What does he do?
He's a director and he's a documentary cameraman.
Wow.
So, we would work, for a while we were working every other year, but that was hard to sustain.
Favorite project that you ever worked on?
Well, I didn't mind working on Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I liked Hearts and Minds. I liked War of the Roses. I've liked a lot of the films. And I love the app. And Jodie Foster, we haven't talked about her.
Oh, yeah.
I've worked a lot with
her. Oh,
wait
a minute. You cut Little Man Tate?
Yeah.
Oh, so, okay. So Little Man Tate is a movie that for me is like, I don't know why it isn't held up as one of the greatest dramas ever made. Just a wonderful...
Music to my ears.
It's just a wonderful, wonderful picture. And anybody can watch that movie anytime. Kind of like Matilda. Watch that Little Man Tate anytime, and it's just a fabulous picture. The boy's performance
is amazing.
Is amazing.
Yeah.
How did she get that moment of being with Kofor? I never forgot it. With the, you know what I'm saying, with the plate. There's kids. It's like there's a few short beats you hit with Jodie Foster in the cutting to build the kid being born, the baby being born before we get to age 8 or whatever he is. And one of them is he's slapping a plate against the table as a baby. Saying Kofor, Kofor.
Oh, yeah.
And then she holds up the plate, realizes that the name of the plate on the bottom is Kofor. I don't know how she got the kid to do that. I was just like wondering. Like,
I have to see this and see it.
See it again.
To know, yeah. But she's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another question about the movie. Again, I don't know if you remember it. If you do, great. If you don't, don't worry about it. He plays pool with
Harry Connick.
Harry Connick Jr., who gave a great performance.
Now, that was one of his earliest performances.
Right.
And I feel like I had something to do with that. Because there were moments when, you know, that was a piece by piece. He's wonderful. Everything about that guy is wonderful. And the charm that pours out of him was always there. But to get it to be a whole performance took a little work. It was there.
Right. But you had to.
No matter how much work I did. It was there.
But you had to pull it out. You had to shape it.
I had to shape it
a
little bit. Yeah.
So when they're playing pool, we added some effects, some very crude effects, like the rotation of the ball and the uh-huh. arrows and all the things that...
effects were crude then.
Yeah, but it works perfectly in this because it's about this boy's perspective on... this genius's perspective on the world.
Yeah.
Right? You know, was that something that you sort of played around with, or you suggested, or was it written in the script, or was it Jody's idea?
It was Jody's idea. She worked on the script.
Do you have a favorite moment in that movie when you watch it?
I just like a lot of her warmth toward the kid in the movie. I really enjoyed that. Her trying to be the best mother she could be, considering that her son was so much smarter than she would ever dream of being, and having to give up some of that in order to nurture that brilliance. To me, that was a very lovely performance.
Right. I'll tell you what, actually, I think is my favorite moment of editing in the movie, now that I think about it. When he, when the boy, it's about a genius, the movie's about a genius boy who has to basically find a new way to live because he can't obviously go to school with, oh, and that great moment, how many of these are divisible by two? All of them. You know, this great moment in the classroom. He can't get through this. And so he gets put into school for geniuses and then eventually goes to university at age 8. And it's unlike Doogie Howser or something like that. It's actually believable and real. When he first enters the classroom, the quantum mechanics class, and there's this wonderful big actor who's a teacher, I forget his name.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Josh Mostel.
Right.
Zero Sun.
The way you introduced that character was he just sort of, we're following the boy into class if memory serves, and he sort of comes up beside him from behind. There's no, like, you show a shot of the one character, you show a shot of the other, the eye line match, or, you know, I'm going to go over. It just sort of happens, and he says, you know, don't worry, tell me if you need anything, and here's a seat. And it's only in sort of one simple take or sort of following them. It was just elegant. It just a sort of, to me, it's sort of, I just remember it as being an introduction to a character that you don't see in movies a lot. I really liked it.
Good.
I don't know. You're like, I don't remember what you're talking about, but I'm sure it's great.
Jody.
Yeah.
She was the director.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a beautiful moment.
Yeah.
So tell us about the beaver.
Oh.
Now this is recent.
I'd rather not.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I love Jodie Foster. She's great.
Okay.
There was some lack of support in certain departments that interfered with the movie being what it could have been. But I thought Mel Gibson was wonderful in it. And she's great.
Okay. We will leave it at that.
We better leave it at that.
Lindsay Klingman, thank you for joining
us. Okay.
And I have to say, you know, I mean, I know that, you know, asking questions about stuff that's way deep in the memory banks and all that stuff, but it's a real pleasure and honor to speak with one of the most venerated, experienced, and intelligent editors in the history of business.
You know, I'm terrified of public speaking, so this has been really hard for me. And there are certain things I just felt I couldn't talk about because I don't want to... say things about people that I respect or that would be hurt or mad or worse. It's my caveat.
Worse than hurt and mad?
Yeah. Angry. Revengeful.
Well, we hope you had an okay time here. And there's
yes,
no,
it's been very pleasant.
Well, it's very nice to have you.
Okay, cut.
Let's introduce you now that we shot it, now I have to introduce you.
Okay.
I haven't done the introduction yet.
Okay, do it. Quick.
Welcome back to Craft Truck. In the cut, Lindsay Klingman, picture editor. Welcome.
Thank you.
One of the best.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. It was really great.